that's what we do. And I realized that there is a part of our scripture that has always made me think of that. And that's the story of the Transfiguration. So in the story of the Transfiguration, that reflection, can I share my screen?
Yes.
Ellen?
I can make you the, I can make you the presenter, which I'll do.
Thanks.
You're now the presenter.
Okay. Okay, now how does this work, share my screen?
Well, there's, okay. there's a screen button there if you hit
that. Yeah, I hit. And then I'm going to share. It says share.
Yeah.
Whoops. It says people can see my screen, but then I can't retrieve my document, can I? Maybe I can. Okay. So in the document that says for reflection, did everyone get that document?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So there's a scripture, and it's Matthew 17, 1 through 9, and it's the story of the Transfiguration. So I think for our purposes, we can read that out loud. Would someone like to read that? Don't be shy.
Yeah, so anyone that wants to turn their microphone and read, please do.
Six days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up to a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. Like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and Elijah. While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed. It looks like it's there's.
Ooh.
There's something on the screen. Can't read it.
And a voice, and from the cloud, a voice said, "This is my son, the beloved."
Thank you.
Oh, how weird! It did a weird formatting thing. I don't know why.
Yeah, I can pick it up from there.
Thank you, Alan.
And from a voice said, "This is my son, the beloved. With him, I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Tell no one about the vision till after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead."
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So when we're looking at this, I don't want to do that. How does it allow me to stop sharing?
Or just unshare it. Just click the button.
Well, I did. I paused sharing, but I want to get it off the screen.
Make me the presenter.
How do I do that?
If there's a people drop down with all the people there.
Yep.
You right click me, and here I can do it myself.
Oh, there you go. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, there you Alan. Go. Okay, I'm not used to go to meeting. We use Zoom, so here we go. New tricks. All right. So thank you. So in that particular story of the Transfiguration that I think is pretty familiar to people, there were things about that being a mountaintop experience, right? So we have this mountaintop experience and the disciples are there and it's like nothing they've ever seen before, right? So they try to wrap their heads around it. They try to contain it. They can't, because God blows through and says, and puts a mist over them and says, this is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. And when that happens, here they are stuck with this thing that they don't know what to do with. And then what happens next?
Well, then God speaks.
What happens after God speaks?
Everything goes quiet, and it's Jesus alone with them.
And then what do they do?
And then they're scared, like they're going to run. But then they looked up, and only Jesus was there. Then they went down off the mountain.
Then they went down off the mountain. And what does Jesus tell them?
Be quiet. Don't say anything until I am raised from the dead.
Yep. Yeah. So the thing about it is, and the reason that this touches me so much, this particular experience, is because the experience of being on pilgrimage, once you get like 2 weeks in, becomes an experience that is beyond words. It's hard to articulate. And so I have this great pilgrim experience. I get to Santiago. It's beyond words. I'm not worried about forming words around it. It just is what it is. And then I'm supposed to leave it and go home. But then what happens if I talk about it? If I start to talk about it? What does that do? Elizabeth's talking, but I can't hear her.
Elizabeth, turn your mic on.
Sorry. When you speak it out loud many times, it diminishes it.
Mm-hmm.
It's when it's in your heart and stays in your heart that way. It's like a spiritual, I don't like the word secret, but there's something magical and mystical about it. And then when you speak that, it has a tendency to lose that mysticism and those feelings.
Mm-hmm.
At least it does for me.
Has anybody, so clearly you've had an experience like that leads you to that sort of understanding. Has anybody else had an experience of that where your experience, when you start to put it into words, it reshapes the experience in a way that is different? Anybody have that happen? Troy, you're nodding. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've had that experience. And then when you try to relate it, and some part of you doesn't want to relate it to people, but then you might feel compelled to because of a kind of a social pressure, like, well, how was it? You don't want to seem rude. And yet at the same time, you want to share.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you do share, it's diminished in some way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You want the other person to experience it, though, but you can't put it into words in a way that would make it real for them. And so it's diminished in some way, like Elizabeth said, in my experience.
So Troy, have you had an experience of that in particular that you could share?
Yeah, I think I climbed up. Well, there's been a few things. It usually has to do with nature or after some kind of big, I climbed Mount Fuji many years ago, and it's an all-night adventure, and you were going up into different stations, and you watch the sunrise in the morning, and it was very grueling and cold, and coming down off of the mountain, you're on this high, and just kind of make a long story short, the people who picked me up, well, how was it? How was it? They hadn't done it, and I was kind of blottoed, you know. I was kind of like, It's difficult to explain. I tried my best, and it kind of was lacking. Mm-hmm. It was lacking. But I still carried it with me, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Somebody else want to share about that?
Yeah, I've had something similar too, more than once. Hiking with a group of guys in the high country, the back country of the Sierra, generally in Indian summer, and when there are not a lot of people, and it's a very special experience for 4, 5, 6 days, and then when you come back down, literally, you know, you can't really explain it to people, and it's something that is cheapened and diminished the more you attempt to bring it down to sort of the vernacular. It loses some of its specialness.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Somebody else?
Well, I'll share mine.
Go ahead, Ellen.
I went to Crucio. Somebody has their computer and their phone.
Stella, I think.
And so, going to Crucio, it's a 4-day, event is the wrong term, enlightening, just wonderful experience. And when you come back, you come down into the world with your Crucistas no longer there, and it's very hard to explain to people what has happened to you, even if you've had, like I had, almost a mystical experience. And so you come back and it's flat. It's, you know, it's you come down off the mountain, but it's just, there's no one other than people who have been there before that you can relate to. Fortunately, you have Crucio groups that you can talk about with that. Mm-hmm. That same experience happened when we were on team, my wife and I. When Crucio teams, the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Carrie, did you want to share something?
Yes, thank you. What a wonderful topic. I think anytime one has a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience, it's just something that is so powerful that words can't describe it. And I've had many of these kinds of experiences, and I think that it's taking it and reducing it into a funnel, this huge experience, and then we're going to shove it into this and try to have that descriptor be the, you know, one sentence of what is it like to jump out of a plane at, you know, 10,000 feet. You just don't say it. I mean, it's hard to describe it. Or, you know, when, go tell it on the mountain. I mean, it's just hard to describe it unless you're there. And I just think that it's, you know, it's so magical and so ethereal. And but it's great.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Carrie. Does someone else want to share? Anybody else?
I'll share just briefly. Many years ago, my husband and I used to do mission trips with students, and we'd do humanitarian outreach, and they were all faith-based projects, but we sort of, in our own experience of going between cultures, felt this disconnect of how to speak about things. And so as we had known that, we began to sort of prepare the students that they would experience something similar once they'd go on this kind of trip with a group of people where they become extremely close and they do some things that really may ignite in them a greater desire to do something similar. And then they're going to go back home. And it's like going back into a foreign land again. Your home will no longer be the same once you've gone. because now you're different as you go back. So anyway, just a translation issue.
Yeah. So one of the things that happened, so in the mountaintop experience and the transfiguration, the Bible doesn't tell us what happens when they go back down. It just kind of leaves us hanging there to kind of assume what's really going on. And that's actually where this, my own story on this really picks up again, is what happens when I went, what happened when I went back home? What happened? So I should tell you as background that this was a sabbatical given to me by my congregation. And they, and I felt this very strange thing that, you know, I was here, I was away from my congregation. So therefore I needed to somehow, figure out how I was going to tell the story. And so when I first started on the Camino itself, I was collecting mentally, collecting stories. And it was as though the narrative of what was happening was being formed into words in my brain. About 2 weeks in, the words vanished. There were no words. And I didn't want words. And I didn't worry about the story. My husband had the foresight to say to me, take a picture once in a while, which I didn't know that that would be useful. But as it turned out, when I came back and my congregation was saying to me, well, how was it? How was it? And of course, they needed to know how it was. And so I sifted through the pictures to find a, to try to find the story that connected with that, in order to give them something, some sort of feeding from it. But I hated doing it. I hated finding the words, because it was almost as though in finding the words that I was betraying the authenticity of the experience. And so I really struggled with that. And as you were saying, Troy, every time somebody would ask me, I would just cringe because I didn't want to shape it into that story, right? Where it's, she has a great story about her pilgrimage, right? And so there was that, that would happen. So when Jesus says to them, don't tell anybody, I always think that's a way of saying nobody's going to get it anyway. So preserve the integrity of the experience by holding on to it. And so I wanted to do that. I really did. But of course, I couldn't. Over time, then that experience that I had as a pilgrim started to be reshaped. It started to be reshaped. And as it started to reshape itself, then I had to grab the nuggets of what was really important about that experience that I could hold tightly. I think that one of the things that I encountered was the way that people wanted to take that mountaintop experience and put it into some sort of measurable achievement form. In other words, it was as though, oh, she walked 500 miles. Wow, right? Or he climbed Mount Fuji, or, you know, whatever the thing is that people can grab a hold of, right? That they wanted to, you know, it's almost like I'm friends with her, and she walked 500 miles, right? So there was a bit of that sort of vicarious thrill that was happening. And I often wondered, you know, could you imagine if the disciples, you know, had gone down and told the story, and people were saying, oh, well, they might have said they were crazy, but they might have said, oh, you know, I'm friends with Peter, and he was up in that mountain and saw that weird thing happening, right? So weighing that was a really, that was hard. That was a really hard part of coming home, was that. So in the short term, the experience, in the short term, what I was working on was, how do I find words that are the most authentic expression of the experience that I could? And how do I keep myself from chafing against that desire to contain, that people have to contain an experience in language? And I'm sure that's, you know, that's what we've been kind of talking about. So that was in the short term. In the long term, what happened was very different. And this is what I didn't expect. I did not expect the way that I would never lose that experience. I didn't expect the way that it would transform my life, my entire life. It wasn't just in a container that happened those 10 years ago in Spain. It actually reshaped how I live, my ministry, my leadership style, my understanding of people. And those were things I did not know would happen. So one of the things that happened when I went on the Camino was that I was exhausted. And you know how it is when you feel burned out by what you're doing? You feel burned out and you're done and you can't do it anymore. So 10 years ago when I went on the Camino, I wasn't sure I could handle being a priest anymore. I was exhausted. Huh. I was exhausted with being a priest. And so I went incognito. And I didn't tell anybody that I was a priest. But as I made my way through the pilgrimage, I realized that I could never stop being a priest. And what that, because there was just automatic care of others that was happening the whole way. And I realized when I came back long term that that's just who I am, right? That pastoring part of me is just who I am. It's part of my identity, my calling, and that never goes away. And it doesn't matter how tired I get, it never goes away. And there was something reassuring about that. Very reassuring. Another long-term thing that emerged for me, and you can probably relate to this, is that I realized that I don't necessarily have to find words for everything. I see some smiles on that one. Don't necessarily have to find words for everything. It's okay not to have them. It's okay to nod and not answer. It's okay to not be able to articulate fully an experience with God. So, for those of you who were sharing earlier about, you know, that mountaintop experience, which then you're, you know, trying to articulate or not, I think for me, it was the realization that I didn't always have to explain everything. And that was okay. Another thing that I learned is that I can really enjoy my solitude. And in fact, I crave it. Now, if you're an extrovert, you know that you probably, right now in this time of shelter in place, you're probably craving a bit of social interaction, right? So how many of you are craving some social interaction? Yep, me too, right? Yeah.
No, we're fine.
So, you know, I am a person who derives her energy from being in contact with people. And seeing you on a screen is, you know, that's okay. But after a while, I want to go find you so that I can talk to you. And what I learned on this was I actually started to crave my solitude. On the Camino, when I was walking, I walked by myself all day. And so there was nobody with me. And if I met somebody, it would be kind of like a, you know, a wave, but I didn't walk with anybody. I walked on my own pace with myself, day after day, step after step, all of that. And I didn't realize what a deep effect that would have on me. I didn't realize that I would really desire and crave that kind of solitude again. Huh. And I have craved that solitude constantly since then.
Is it different when you became bishop, or it was that ever since you came back?
Ever since I came back. Being a bishop doesn't really have anything to do with it. I was canon to the ordinary before that, so I was out and about all the time with parishes. But I found that then as now, it's no different. I just simply crave the solitude. And by solitude, I mean really that deep, alone, quiet time. Something I never thought I would ever say in my life, but it is really true. The part where I don't have to find words, and the part where I can just be absolutely still. That part.
Okay, thank you.
So you know that Bible verse, the one that says, "Be still and know that I am God"? Huh? That has become one of my favorite things. And one of the things I love about it is that you can take your yourself to that deeper place of solitude by simply taking off the end word. So you can start out by thinking, "Be still and know that I am God," and then "Be still and know that I am," and then "Be still and know that I," and "Be still and know that," "Be still and know," "Be still and," "Be still, be." And that's where the solitude is. Hmm. So that was an unusual, for me, that was a really unexpected byproduct, a product of the pilgrimage. Another thing that I learned was, you know, when you're on a pilgrimage like that, you have nobody to face but yourself. There's nobody walking it but you. There's nobody in your shoes but you. And I began to realize that as I was walking, that not everybody had the same intention around their pilgrimage. Not everyone had the same understanding of what that pilgrimage was to be about. For some, it was an athletic event. For some, it was a chance to study history. For some, it was a chance to be socializing with their friends. For some, it was a tourist attraction. Not everybody had the ability to walk 500 miles. Some walked 80. Some took trains. Some took buses. Some would walk 5 miles and then grab a taxi. There were all these different ways of approaching the pilgrimage. And I had not realized how judgmental I could be about the way that other people were approaching their pilgrimages. There was a waiter in a restaurant who told me, he heard me make some snarky comment about the busload of people who showed up. And I said, those aren't pilgrims. And he looked at me and he said, ma'am, everybody on this thing is a pilgrim. They're just doing it in different ways. And I thought about how true that is in our spiritual lives. And when I came back, I realized with much more depth how we're all pilgrims. It's just that we have our own abilities and capabilities and limitations around that. And some of us are very equipped to go the long haul and the hard road, and some can't do that. And yet we're all pilgrims. And I don't know your life circumstances, so who am I to judge you for that? Anybody want to talk about that a little more?
Carrie, go ahead.
I would like to. We all have a different way of going on this journey. And what works for me on a daily basis to connect with the Lord in the morning and throughout the day is going to be different for Elizabeth, Cynthia, or Alan. And I have to remember to be accepting of all, and whatever avenue that one chooses to know their God.
That's your mute button. Thank you.
I'm on now.
And Green needs to go. Big girl.
Oh, I want to say to each in his own way. We're doing nothing here but walking in nature, which is now splendid and so pure because we don't have lots of flights going up over us. So the sky is just pristine, and it's just a time to pause and appreciate something that wouldn't have happened here for 50 years, I don't think. It's just wonderful.
Anyone else?
I had to unmute myself, and then I got cut off, and then I'm back. But I, so before I answer, I want to make sure I have the right question. Can you repeat the question?
I was talking about the role of how judgmental we can be about the pilgrimage of others. And I was asking if anybody wanted to comment about that.
Yes. You know, recently with being in so much pain from before I had my hip replacement surgery, I realized how much I didn't pay attention to people who are walking with canes or walkers or, you know, going into Safeway or something like that. And being in so much pain helped me realize, helped me be more compassionate to who they were and are, and that I would always smile and take care of them because so many people smiled and took care of me. And I always felt that I was a compassionate person. So it's not necessarily judgment, but a new perspective. That kind of like what you were saying, Bishop Lucinda, that there's a new perspective and I'll realize, oh, everybody's on this pilgrimage in different ways. And so learning about pain helped me see others in a different way. And I'm eternally grateful for it.
One of the things that I realized was that I didn't know people's backstories. Mm-hmm. And so I was holding people to to a certain level that if you're doing this, this makes you a pilgrim. And I met, you know, some people with some very serious issues on that pilgrimage. One woman was dying, and she had taken care of her husband and her children, and her doctor diagnosed her with cancer. And so she came on the Camino. She just started walking, and she really couldn't walk the whole thing. She could walk portions of it at a time. But I realized when I heard her story that who was I to judge her ability and her commitment as a pilgrim? And it really helped me, I think, to understand people in parishes, you know, people who didn't come to church very often, or people who didn't go to Bible study, or whatever requirement I had of them on their spiritual pilgrimage, that I didn't always know the backstory. And so it really, I had to face that piece of myself that I didn't even realize was there. So that was an interesting bit. Another thing that I realized on the pilgrimage that really shaped the way I thought of things afterwards was that every step that I took mattered. Because if I didn't attend to my steps, I could injure myself. I could break my leg. I could fracture my ankle. I could fall off the edge of something. I could bruise myself, whatever it was, but every step was significant. And afterwards, I realized that it was a good exercise in paying attention to exactly where I am in every moment. That every part of every larger decision that is made is significant. Every piece, every conversation. That was a longer term effect too, was giving each thing, each aspect value. And I can't do it, of course, of every moment of every day. but it is important and it is significant. So every step matters. Another thing that was really amazing to me is that I had to learn to accept help when I was on the pilgrimage. If I was lost, or if I was hurting or anything like that, I had to learn to accept the help that was being offered. I don't know about you, but I've tended to be a person who was pretty dang capable on my own. And I could do it myself, right? And when I, on the pilgrimage, when I needed to accept help, when my back went out, and I ended up crawling, and my husband had to help me, and then a person that I didn't even know helped me to understand what was going on with my body at that point. I had to learn that that was important. And people offered help all the time. And I needed to learn that that was okay for me to receive, was that help. Because I was so used to giving it, right? I was used to being in charge of all of that. Another thing that I realized too is that God provides all the time. There were times when I didn't know if I was going to find a bed to sleep in, or if I was going to find food to eat, or any of that. It was, I just didn't know from morning to night what was going to happen. And I really, really began to understand that if God provided, if there wasn't a bed for me, God would provide a front porch for me to sleep on. If there wasn't, an apple for me, God would provide me with bread. And those were things I didn't expect. And that has made my post-pilgrimage experience much different, because I have realized that God constantly provides for me, puts people in my path, puts things in my path that are there. And they may not be exactly what I expect, but they are a provision of God. So any thoughts about that?
Well, I can remember when I was a student in Europe many years ago, back in the 60s, and we had time off between quarters, and a couple of other guys and I drove all over Western Europe in a VW. And, at first, when we'd roll into a town and have no idea where we're going to sleep or eat or something, that was pretty stressful, but after a little while, it sort of went away. Something always turned up. There was always a place, be it a youth hostel, or we didn't end up on front porches, but we came close.
You were in the field.
One night we did sleep wrapped in our overcoats in a field, and it was very cold. But the next morning we, hiked on a little bit and, got the car and drove a little further to some people we knew, and they served us this incredible, rich, thick, hot chocolate in mugs like this big, and baguettes, and that sort of took care of everything. And we were provided for.
Mm-hmm. There was, one night, toward the end of our journey, my husband was on bicycle, and he was out on the road, And so we would meet up in the evenings. And I had climbed this peak that was called El Cebreiro. And he had gone on the bicycle route, which was kilometers away from where I was. And as night was approaching, I finished that climb and I came into the village at the top. And just as I came into the village at the top, the mist came down because it was a very foggy area. And I had no idea of where my husband was, where Bob was. And I was it was a tiny little place, like a little hamlet, basically. And I was wandering around. And I wandered into this open doorway. And this woman was there, kind of a crusty woman behind the bar. And she looked at me and she said, where are your companions? And I said, I don't have any. My husband's on a bike and he's lost. I can't find him. And she said, you must go find him. And I was like, of course, right? So I went and I looked for him. And then I came back and I said, I can't find him. Well, she kicked everybody out of the bar. And she helped me and gave me water and said, go stand and, you know, by this road. Well, long story short, eventually I saw his blinking bike light. And that was about an hour later. And she had originally had no place for us to stay. There was no food. Everything was closed. And instead, here we were, these two. I was terrified. He was terrified. And by the time I got him to where her open door was, she simply sat us down, made us a meal, and gave us a bed upstairs. You know, and it was just, I really felt that God had provided for both of us. And we were so scared. We were so scared. And that made me realize that there was just, you know, all the time God is doing that. If my eyes are open, there are people who are stepping in to offer help. There are people who are being, I think, agents of God. Sometimes messengers or angels of God who are really part of God's providing for me and for the people that I love and care about. So people say, and you kind of brought that thing up earlier, Alan, about, you know, did this happen when you became a bishop, or, you know, in terms of how I, you know, was relating to the things. And I realized that, in fact, it shaped the way that this pilgrimage has shaped my understanding of leadership in the church in a very deep spiritual way. And it's stuff that I've talked about here in this diocese with you. Those of you who attended Diocesan Convention, you listened to my video last week, you have heard me say three things. One is travel light. Another is stay in balance. The third is have the courage to become lost. I think that as leaders of the church that is emerging, the church that is happening, our lives that are being reshaped by things we don't always understand. Traveling light means really just having what we need, not encumbering ourselves with a whole bunch of extra structures or extra distractions or anything, just what we need. The simplicity of that's really important. Staying in balance. Anybody knows that when you pack a backpack, you've got to have it even or it's going to really mess up your back and the way you walk, right? And staying in balance in the church really has to do with how we look at our tradition, which is so beautiful, and put weigh that with what are new things that are emerging, new creative, innovative things that are emerging, and holding those two together so that we don't get stuck in our tradition and we don't move too quickly into innovation and creativity in ways that we ignore our tradition. So that staying in balance is very important, I think. And the third lesson from the Camino that informs my leadership is having the courage to be lost. When you're on pilgrimage, sometimes you miss the signs. Sometimes you don't know where you're going. You just sort of head in a general direction sometimes. And I think that that is the truth about where we are as church here in the 21st century, that we don't always know where we're going. All the plans that we make that used to work really well don't always work now. How we are to minister in this world is different. It has been reshaped. And so if we're true to God's calling, then we have to wander a bit and sometimes be lost. And I think that's important, and it's faithful. It's a real faithful thing to do. So those are the things that I learned on the way back. This is what life is like after the Camino for me. Are there any thoughts or questions, comments, things you want to talk about some more?
Bishop Lucinda, I've got just a technical question. How many miles a day did you walk?
It depended on the day, but several times I do like 35. I think my shortest day was 12. My longest day was probably 35. I tended toward the 25 range a lot. So it just depended on the terrain and the way that things were, weather, all those things.
That's a lot of miles every day.
Yeah, it's interesting because you know how you can do it? You can do it once. So, you know, you can do 25 miles one day and think, oh, I can do this thing. It's nothing, but it's day after day after day after day that really wears your body. And so, yeah, it was a lot of miles.
So you took 30, 40 days all told, or how long?
34 days on the Camino, 41 total, because I took rest days where I would just rest, take a shower, put my feet up, do nothing. I realized the importance of Sabbath time. I forgot to put that on here.
So I have a, I'm sorry, are you done, Bob?
Yes, thanks, Carrie.
Okay. I have a question about how you must have grown in humility in that journey.
Oh.
Because you were, I mean, you know, to be able to be lost, one needs to ask for help, right? Mm-hmm. And that is not always easy for some. And I think humbling oneself to be at that state of mind, you know? Every day.
I think, Carrie, that really that was the lesson of the whole thing, was a lesson in humility. It was, I absolutely had to realize that I couldn't handle everything, that I had no control over anything, that I was only human, that I was not self-sufficient. That I, in fact, was just kind of a wandering, lost little soul. And And the humility of that was intense because, you know, I've always been a very capable, you know, straight A, top achiever, you know, that person. And this just stripped that all down. There was none of that left. Yeah, it was very humbling. And asking for help was a huge thing.
So yeah. I imagine it shaped your identity tremendously, didn't it? I mean, it really just strips you of everything. And then
yes.
coming back, this transfiguration, the transformation is so different from the person you set out initially.
It was interesting because my stepfather, who was a United Methodist minister, asked me at the very end, one night I went to visit them and I took all my 700 and whatever pictures, whatever. And, you know, I bored them to death with just kind of flipping through slides because I still didn't have words. It was about 6 months later. And he said, what did you learn the most? And I said that I didn't have anything to prove. And I don't know where that came from, but it just came out of my mouth. So that all that striving, all that achieving, all of that, that was pretty stripped away.
I have two questions, Bishop. You mentioned when you started that you went a bit incognito being a priest. At what point on the cameo did you unveil that fact, or did you ever?
There was one point when I unveiled it. So there were two things. Well, I found myself helping people, even though I didn't want to get involved in their issues, right? One was I encountered a woman, and this is an incredible story, but the short version is that she was kind of odd, and then I found her in a field crying, and I went to talk to her, and I asked her why she was on the Camino, and her husband had died a month before, and she didn't know what to do, so she threw her stuff in a backpack and came to do the Camino. And I didn't tell her I was a priest. That wasn't what she needed, but I did pray for her. And I told her I would continue to pray for her. And then a couple days later, I was in a thunderstorm, and this woman came up beside me, and she said, you know, it's pouring. Do you want to keep going? And so I walked with her for 2 hours, and she was the only one I did this with. And so we fell into conversation, and she said, I'm the only police woman in the police force in Valencia. I'm the first one. I'm the only one. And I said, wow, I've never met a policewoman from Valencia. And she said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a priest. And she said, well, I've never met a woman who was a priest. So at that point, I was, you know, that was the only time.
Thanks. My other question was, what did you start out to do the Camino? What was your goal? Was it to walk 500 miles? Or you said your life changed as you went through it, but what was your starting point that changed so much?
So when I started out, my intent was to have the experience of pilgrimage walking the Camino, which was a pilgrimage that I'd been reading about in medieval Spanish literature since I was in college. Because it's all in that literature that it existed. And so it was kind of more of a curiosity. I was curious, but I was open to whatever was going to happen when I started on it, which I think is actually really important. But it was about 2 weeks in where I really started to notice that a transformation was happening that wasn't something that I could have conceived beforehand. So Yeah, my intent was to have the experience of pilgrimage, but it was sort of like a, you know, the planned thing, I think. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else have questions? They turn your mics on and ask the bishop while you're while we're here.
I have just something that I just wanted to comment on. Thank you for your stories, Bishop. And I just can't help but see the parallels with the pilgrimage that you were describing, with how humanity is on a pilgrimage with this COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like everything you said corresponds to, you know, the uncertainty that you talked about, the trusting, the seeking for help, and the meaning afterwards. Who, like, after you came back from the pilgrimage, how you had to kind of not reinvent yourself, but who were you as a result of the Camino? I wonder who we will be as a people as a result of this. Who will we be on the other side of this?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to have your comments about that, if anything comes up for you or anyone.
You know, it's such a very important point. I think that it's interesting to watch during this time how the desire is to, on the part of everyone, is to have an adventure. And if you have an adventure, then it can go back to the way it was, right? So we're on this adventure, and we're all going to do virtual things for a while, and then we'll go back to the way we were. And that's, we're being reshaped right now. And there are some amazing things happening on this pilgrimage, where people are helping each other. You know, they are, not everybody's behaving well, because that's what people do. But a lot of people are helping each other and asking for help and not knowing what's going to happen one day to the next. And having to sort of realize that we're not in control, which is a huge issue for us, especially in Western society, right? And so our own kind of individualistic, I got this covered type thing, isn't working for us very well right now. And so we're called to a different place, for which many are not well prepared, right? And so I think it kind of goes back to suspending judgment. That part about suspending judgment is kind of where we are having to go, because not everybody is handling this very well. And some people are incredibly anxious, and for reasons that you or I may not understand, and it's guiding them. And so, yes, I see a lot of parallels. And I have no idea of where we're going. I know that we're headed some direction and God's in charge. I know that everything I do today matters, but I don't have a clue.
Well, we're called to have the courage to be lost.
Right.
Exactly.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's really living in the unknown and learning to live in the unknown and be okay with it.
Mm-hmm. And that's faithful, Elizabeth. That's so faithful.
Scary, too. Have those moments.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I know. We do have those moments, don't we? Yeah.
I think it's, I don't know quite how to say this. I think this is, thanks to the technologies we have, it's perhaps easier than it might otherwise have been.
Yeah.
I've been trying to avoid rereading Albert Camus' The Plague.
Oh, yeah.
That book struck me in college. Because they were isolated. We're not, you know, this is amazing. What I see a bunch of faces here. Our church service on Sunday was just beautiful. Prior to this call, we just got off a FaceTime call with a couple of my cousins in Australia talking about what they're going through and the issues and all of that stuff. And we felt a sense of connection with them. And I think that's what makes it a little bit, this version of humanity's journey, a little bit easier than it might otherwise be. And for that, I'm really grateful. I think I'm less alone than we might otherwise be. And that's a good thing.
So there's something I was thinking about that I've been kind of sharing with the staff a little bit, which is via Zoom, which is, you know, people have been talking, I've heard language kind of floating around about, oh, what a sacrifice this is, okay? And the language that's being used, that sacrifice has been sort of like, we're having to give stuff up. We can't do what we want, right? It's been a kind of a resentful, almost an angry type of thing. But if you look at the actual meaning of the word sacrifice, it means a holy offering. A holy offering. And so when we think about how this is in this day, how I live my life is a holy offering, so that, you know, I'm staying sheltered in place so that I'm not making it worse for somebody else, right? So that's a holy offering that I have to make. I'm giving up what makes me comfortable and that sense of independence I have that I can do whatever I want, and that's a holy offering, right? So I've been really working with that sense of that in terms of how that reframes the way that we approach this entire thing, that we have an incredible opportunity to grow together in ways that we didn't really think of before, and to spiritually tend and pastorally tend to others in ways that we might have ignored before. So I give that to you.
Thank you.
Cynthia or Amber, anything else?
Thank you.
Yes, heartfelt thanks, Bishop Lucinda. Really wonderful to. I feel very encouraged, actually. I'm circling around this courage to be lost concept you've put forward, and the humility in that and the acceptance in that. And what does that look like? So.
For me, it's also the realization that in some ways we're always have been lost. You know, I mean, it's just that humility. And this is just it's this huge 2x4. I mean, this is what faith is about, right? And now it's our time to really live into it. So thank you, Bishop Lucinda. I love that, the courage to be lost. Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Polly, is that, you know, it's actually, we've kind of been living into this false sense that somehow we're in charge and we always know where we're going.
Right.
You know what? I always thought that pilgrimage was some kind of masochism. Because all that walking, you must have been very hard on your feet. You know, you must have been with blisters and all kind of those things. No? Okay. Well, that's what I thought before. That's what I thought.
You know why? It's because I walked for 2 years before I did the Camino, and I tried on 40 pairs of boots.
Okay, so you were training for that. That's cool. Let me finish. I haven't finished yet. I've seen in Mexico the pilgrimage that they do. You know?
Oh, yeah.
They walk like 100 miles or whatever.
What that means?
And there's little kids, middle-aged ladies, all kinds. Some go on their knees. And I see this in to me, that was a masochism, people who are fanatics. They think that by doing that, they're going to have miracles in their life and all this stuff. And it isn't true. To me, it was ignorant people does that. But now when you're telling this, a person who is highly educated and with a lot of experience, the way that you pointed it is not masochism. It doesn't look like, you know. I don't know. It's more like a devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that also, that having the courage to get lost. Because that's one of the fears of the people. I have that fear. It comes to me in nightmares. My most recurring nightmare is to be lost.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, that I park my car somewhere and I can't find it. Or suddenly I'm in a strange city and I'm walking and I don't know where to go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the fear of getting lost.
Yes.
So now I understand your point and appreciate what you said. Thank you.
Thank you, Roberto, because when you talk about devotion, I think I went in over 100 churches when I was in Spain. And because I kept going in and I would light candles because somebody would come to my mind. And so mm-hmm. I would go in. And I would light a candle and pray. And for me, it really was deeply devotional. And the reason I laughed about the blisters was because I really didn't want my body to stop me from being able to really have a full pilgrimage. And so that was something that was very important to me. But I appreciate what you say about devotion, because that really was true. And that's a whole nother topic, too. Yeah.
Good.
Well, Bishop Lucinda, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us and helping us see the beauty of your pilgrimage and the thoughts you left with us. And we'll all have the courage to be lost from now on. So thank you.
Thank you
so much. I appreciate you giving the time.
Thank you.
Thanks. I hope I actually see you soon.
Thank you for your time.
Good night.
Busy time.
Thank you, Bishop.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye. Good night.
Thank you.